Chapter 2, verse 14.
Erasing the record that stood against us with its legal decrees. The word in Greek is dogma. You've heard the word in English often enough, the plural, dogmata. Well, you can translate it demands, but I think it's a decree that he's saying. So when you were baptized, the record that stood against us, see, it's a record of human sin that we all remember and wish we hadn't done and all that. Well, this record, according to Jewish tradition, was made by the recording angels. We've still got that idea in our own mythology, showing that we've sinned and deserve. And we talk about the books were opened, you know, from the book of Daniel, and you've got a record on one side of the ledger of sin and a record. I mean, it's only an image. But it's the real life that we have, that where our life is going to be judged by what we've done. So we imagine, and they imagined, a recording angel. Well, these people who are trying to entice the Christian group in Colossae, they're talking about, okay, you've got to get the angels on side, get them to change the record. You know, get them on side with you. And if you worship the angels or join their worship of God, then you'll have all these heavenly beings that are on your side when the last judgment comes, and you can all imagine that. Well, he's saying, Christ erased the record. He rubbed it out. That's the way they had to do things, rub it out, because it was fairly hard, erasing something off a piece of skin, parchment. So they had to rub to kind of get it back to the original fibre, as it were, and even then you can still read underneath. That's what a palimpsest is called. That's why we often keep discovering ancient documents, by the way, in libraries. There might be, and they found, for example, they find a hymn or something in a library, but then if they can somehow get behind the hymn, they find that, for example, Seneca's De Senectute, I think, was discovered like that, or one of Seneca's great works. It's only discovered in the last 100 or so years. The reason they discovered it was that it was actually rubbed out and something else written on top of it, because you couldn't afford the new. But they were able to re-find it by imaging and whatever else they do, a whole process. So that's called a palimpsest. Well, Christ erased it. He set it aside. He nailed it to the cross. When he was nailed to the cross, his love was there to nail everything you'd done wrong to the cross. Bury it, kill it, gone, finished. Wiped out by love. And here a lovely image too. He displayed to public view the rulers and the authorities. And in his triumphant victory procession, he showed them as they truly are, in him. Now that verse, there's libraries written on it, verse 15, chapter 2 of Colossians. And the reason is that he uses two verbs. Displayed to public view, that's the only time it's ever used in the Bible. So Paul hasn't used it elsewhere, no one else uses it. So if you've got a word that's only used once, it's not easy to get its exact nuance. You haven't got much to compare it with. Likewise, showed them as they truly are. That's the only time Paul uses it in all his writings, that verb. It's one verb, showed them as they truly are. So I don't have to explain it. That's why it's difficult to see how does Paul use this word? Because you can't find out. He doesn't use it anywhere else. How does the New Testament understand? So you'll get different nuances, and the New Revised Standard Version takes one lean on it. I'm holding back from either lean because I think Paul isn't clear. The image is clear. You've got a procession, a triumphal procession. That much is certain. So you've got a triumphant procession. Imagine the city of Colossae. Imagine a battle. Let's say the Battle of Philippi, when Cassius and Brutus were defeated by Mark Antony and the man who became Caesar Augustus. What was his name? Octavian. So when these two they defeated, well, Philippi, which was set up as a colony then, imagine coming through the city and the captives. So you've got an image of a general at the head of a triumphant procession. That's the image. Now, what we're not sure is, are these principalities and powers and all that, are they being dragged along behind as slaves, as defeated, you know, with naked and with a rope around their neck and laughed at and jeered at and eggs and tomatoes thrown at them and everything else you can get hold of, boo, jeer, because these great generals of the defeated army. Is that the image? Or are they coming along as part of the retinue? Are they the other victorious soldiers who were also in the retinue? Do you get me? So I think the New Revised Standard Version says he disarmed the ruler's authority and made public example of them, triumphing over them in it. That's how they translate this sentence. They have assumed that these angelic powers have been defeated by Jesus. See that? But that's not, the Greek doesn't necessarily say that. It may be that they're coming as part of, in other words, and I think this is the case, I think Paul doesn't take, that's not his interest. He's not saying they've been defeated. What he's saying is that they are in him. Whether they're bad or good is not Paul's interest. The thing is, Jesus is the triumphant general, and they're part of the, whichever way you want to take it, he's not, it doesn't even enter the question. So they're not necessarily defeated. They may be part of Jesus. They may be good, but they're not separate from Jesus. They're part of his. They share in the triumph of the victorious general. Either way, the focus is on Christ, and that's the only thing Paul says. And I think we have to leave the rest as unknown. I'm telling you that because you might know from the New Revised Version that it is capable of another interpretation. And he's getting close to the end, his conclusion. Therefore, do not let anyone condemn you in matters of food and drink or observing festivals, new moons or Sabbaths. The fact that Sabbaths is mentioned indicates a Jewish influence, just as circumcision did a few verses back. So, but new moons, festivals, food and drink, that might, food and drink may also be Jewish, but a lot of it's a mixture. It's an eclectic thing, full of a million ideas. And people saying, you've got to eat this, you can't eat that, you're not allowed to have more than 3.5 ounces of meat on Friday. Anyone heard that before? These are the things there, and they're all right. They're not a big issue, really. But they're, no, whatever he says is, these are only a shadow of what is to come. These aren't the defining things of being Christian. The substance belongs to Christ. And the Greek word is soma, the body. Again, somatikos, I mentioned earlier, means reality as well as body. So the reality, the substance, what really matters is Christ. In Christ the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. Same word here. Don't let anyone disqualify you. Insisting on humility is the word, tapenophrosune. Insisting on humility, nothing wrong with humility. Humility is beautiful, but they're insisting on the wrong kind of humility. It's not really humility at all. Worship of angels could be, it's ambiguous, could be worship, angels are the object of your worship, or joining in the angels' worship of God. So you can't say, it's just worship to do with the angels, or dwelling on visions. Obviously, this group is saying, look, we've got all these visions. And this happens in the church today, too. Be careful of, doesn't mean it's all wrong. Let's be careful. But when people go off on a tangent about apparitions, whoever it is, Mary seems to be appearing all over the world. And most of the things, if Mary is saying it, they're not Christian, so I don't know what she's doing. She must, something's going wrong somewhere in heaven or, so I presume it isn't Mary at all. I presume Mary is appearing. Yeah, I don't say it's wrong that Mary's there. But who's putting the words on what Mary's saying? Because she's not talking words. She's trying to engage people, and the words are the words that come into the minds of the children or the person who's in ecstasy, and then they go to spiritual direction to a Franciscan somewhere who belongs to a certain culture, and he finds the words. And so the words end up, and that's why the church is so insistent, our faith is not based on private revelation. And when people are more sure of what Mary is saying in Bosnia somewhere than they are of the gospel, we've got an enormous problem on our hands. Because it's not revelation, and we're not supposed to base our faith on it. It might pick up things we need to remember, The Catechism is perfectly clear on this. Look it up under private revelation. You'll see this. It's a traditional teaching of the Church. And then, so very often, when you keep finding that the words that the person who has this experience of mystery puts on what's being said, when you find they are actually based on fear, based on a narrow view of the world, not on love often, but on punishment and not... like, there's something you read... oh, read Jesus, for heaven's sake. Go back to our traditions rather than that. And that, I don't mean that, of course, to dismiss it all. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just saying, by their fruit you'll know. So, keep our balance. And that's what he's talking about here. Humility, worship of angels, dwelling on visions. Check the vision. Puffed up with the core, without cause by a human way of thinking. This is all Paul. This is what's happening. And if people get puffed up by their way of thinking and think they've got all the truth, and the Pope included, and all these other people have gone off on a tangent and they've got it wrong, or the bishops are wrong, or not holding to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and held together by its ligaments and sinews, grows with a growth that's from God. So, I don't have to explain that, do I? Paul's saying, stay with the head, stay with the source. The head, meaning the head of the river, you know, the kind of where all the spring from which all life comes. Stay with him. Stay with the body. Stay with the communion. Stay with the church. Stay with what you've learnt and what you've been taught. And don't go herring off into this sectarian stuff that by its fruits is showing that it's out of touch. The growth he wants to come from God. That's Paul's problem. We haven't got that particular problem. But you and I have to be careful always, because these things keep coming up in the community of faith. And if with Christ, it's a big if you died to the principles of this world, if you died to a way of life where you were taking your cue from what the world is saying, without openness to revelation, why do you live as though you still belong to the world? Why do you submit to regulations? Why are you doing what the mystagogues in your little group are saying? You can't do this, you must do that, you must do this five times, you must say this prayer. Say the prayer! For 9 First Fridays, do it. But you don't have to do it. You don't have to ask anyone else to do it. Do it if you want to do it. Do every Saturday go and have a beautiful Mass to Mary. What a lovely thing to do. But do it freely, because it's fruitful. Don't feel you must do it. Say all these prayers at night if you want to. But am I the only one who's met people who have to get through their prayers? And there's 16 of them, and there's 17 of them, and they're praying for this one, and that one, and that one, and they've got a headache in the head, and they're depressed, and they're going through all these terrible things that are happening in their family, and by the end of the prayer, they're totally exhausted, and their wife or husband, that's the end of that, because they're too exhausted to do anything, and love seems to have gone out, and so the poor people need help to say, a prayer is being in communion with God. So if we want to know how to say all these prayers, the best advice I could give you would be the advice that I get from Julian of Norwich, the earliest British mystic, the time of Chaucer, living through the Black Plague and the Wars of the Roses, or was it early in the war? Anyhow, the whole place was being torn to bits by war and violence and plague, so she wasn't living in an idyllic little valley somewhere in England, in green England. Oh, to be in England now that April's there. She's living in the real world, but she's a peaceful, beautiful writer. Make sure you've read Julian of Norwich. She's just so gorgeous on God's love and forgiveness. And there's the feminine. Really good stuff. She would have been a great spiritual director. What am I trying to tell you about? Oh, this is how she says to pray. She says, when you pray, petition prayers, think of the person you want to pray for, your daughter or your husband or someone whose marriage is in difficulty or whatever it is. Think of the person. Imaginatively take them into your heart, because that's where you're thinking from. Hold your heart up to God, and then forget it. That's it. No more. Don't go telling God all about your daughter or your husband or your wife or your kids, or I presume God already knows. doesn't need your information. So what you're doing is you're bringing the person that you love into your heart, which is the only place to pray from. You lift your heart to God, and then you go into prayer, which means you go into silence. You go into communion, and just pray. Be there. Don't be talking. Listening. You know, we're going to pray differently, but that's rather good advice. So just, you've got all the worries in the world, we'll bring them into your heart, hold your heart up to God and let God bathe the springs of water, or the love or the warmth. Otherwise, why spend 3/4 of an hour running through a million statements that you're not making, but you've read? Finally, of course, I'm not here to tell you how to pray, but you pray the best you can. But if prayer is becoming a headache, stop it, because it's not prayer. Just prayer is being in letting God put his arms around you and hold you. So here it is. Why do you submit to regulations? Don't handle this. Don't taste that. Don't touch that. God, says Paul, all these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They're simply human commands and human teachings. They have an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-imposed piety, humility, severe treatment of the body. You sometimes in those little books we used to read, of the saints, you know. Now, let's presume the saint was real, but the person who wrote about the saint was so unreal. So the saint used to drink water coming out of the sink because it was kind of humble to do that. Bloody stupid. Or the saint would lash themselves to blood pouring out. Well, okay, there's some sickness there. That's all right. You can be sick, you can be neurotic, you can still be a saint. But don't call neuroticism virtue. So, okay, anyone can be a saint, whatever our thing. But we don't take that as an example of the way to life. They're self-imposed pieties, says Paul. They're not coming from grace. Humility, putting yourself down, he's talking about here, not real humility. Severe treatment of the body. Now, is he right? They're no value in checking self-indulgence. That's the problem. Without naming anybody, think, have you ever met someone who was very good, very prayerful, and a pain everywhere else?
Yeah.
Now, that's you've got to love them out of it. There's no way else, because it's so hard. But someone's given them the wrong idea, because love doesn't seem to be what's happening. And if it's not loving, it's not God. So don't blame the person. That's the last thing I'd want to do, because that person's in great need and they've got such goodwill. But help the person ease off and let themselves be loved and relax back, as Paul's trying to do here. Because actually, to be a very pious, very good, very faultless, very correct, very traditional person can be shockingly self-indulgent. The self's very centre can be. So we all need loving out of such things. The word for humility is tapenophrosune. That's the actual Greek. Let's see how the word is used outside the Bible. The word tapenos means low. So, in Greek usage, it's not a good thing to be low. It's better to be high. It's an evil fate to be reduced by the gods and to attempt to low by others or by the gods. So to be put down is not good. To be lifted up is good in the Greek world. At the same time, in the Greek world outside the Bible, one is necessarily low in relation to the gods, and to attempt to reject one's fate is pride, hubris. It's in all the Greek dramas. One of the main characters is goes beyond Icarus, you know, tries to fly up to the sun and burns his wings. So they recognize the folly of putting yourself higher than you should be, but they still saw being low as not good. Interestingly, Plutarch, Epictetus, and Josephus, all first century writers, and all incidentally after Paul, when they use the word tapenophrosune, which they do, not often, but they do use it, it's always a vice, never a virtue. And for them, they would translate it as being small-minded. Tapenos is low. Phrosune, friend, is the mind. Thinking of yourself as low is what we'd call having a low sense of self, a low self-esteem, which we recognize as not a good thing. So did they. Small-minded, mean-spirited. So the self is important in Greek ethics, so tapenophrosune would not be considered a virtue in the Greek mind. It would actually be a vice to think of yourself as low. Why does Paul use it as a virtue? In the Greek Bible, still prior to the New Testament, there's an extra thing brought in, because while being low isn't good, the fact is that Yahweh cared for the low, you know, cared for the slaves in Egypt. Yahweh has a special regard for people who are low. So that gives it a different feel. Sing for joy, O heavens, exalt, O earth, break forth mountains into singing, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have pity on his afflicted, meaning those who are low, brought low. That's Isaiah 49. Ben Sirach, writing 180, 200 years before Jesus. Those who fear the Lord keep their hearts prepared and bow down their souls in his presence. We're getting close to humility, but not quite there. Twice, I'm leading somewhere, you'll see, twice and twice only in the whole of the Old Testament scriptures, the whole of the Jewish Bible, only twice is the verb, which is related to the word humility, ever used. And they're the two times. The noun humility is never used in the Old Testament. In fact, it appears the first person to use the word humility is Paul. So it's a new word. It's a new word to describe a new virtue that they saw in Jesus. That doesn't make sense without him, but with him does. It's not one of the virtues of the Greek world. The Stoics never write about it. As I've said, it's always a vice. And even that's only after Paul. The evidence isn't there complete, but there is no use of this noun that we can find in the Greek language prior to Paul. Did Paul invent it? Perhaps. But here in the Old Testament, twice, late works, but you've still got at least the verb that's related is used. Here's one, Proverbs 29. A man's pride will bring him low, but the one who is lowly in spirit, tapeno phroneo, who thinks of himself in a lowly way, will obtain honour. And most beautifully, Psalm 130 or 131, 130 because I'm taking from the Greek. And by the way, it's not in the Hebrew text, so you won't find it in your Bible in Psalm 131, but in the Greek Septuagint introduces this verb. Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high, I don't occupy myself with things too great, too marvelous for me. I think of myself humbly. I have lifted up my soul like a child quieted at its mother's breast. Like a child that is quieted is my soul, O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. That line there, I think of myself humbly, is in the Greek, therefore in the Latin, Vulgate, but it's not in the Hebrew. They've interpreted the text to mean it, but the Hebrew doesn't say it. So we've got quite late uses that are helping us, and that's going to be your loveliest image for humility, I think, is a little child holding on to its mother. A little child who's afraid comes to mum scared, and mother is quietening the child. And it's low, it's little, it's needy, and it knows that, but it's still trusting and joyful and at peace because mum's there. So let's look at the word humility where we first appears. It first appears in our letter here, Colossians. We're going to see it next week, but we've already seen it twice today. But here it's put positively. As God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility. He's already said to them, don't be humble by bowing down to angels. Don't go in for that kind. That's not real humility. And he's mentioned it twice today, but here he talks about it as one of the virtues. Kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. He'll use the word also in Ephesians here, beautifully. I beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you've been called with all humility and gentleness and patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And in one of his last letters from prison in Rome, he says, in humility, regard others to be better than yourselves. Let the same mind be in you which was also in Christ. You'll find it in Peter's first letter, and you'll find it in the Acts of the Apostles. But that's the only place you find that this noun used in the New Testament. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. That's all. So what is humility? Humility, as I understand it, is a joyful virtue. It's not putting yourself down. It's recognizing that I am totally needy, totally dependent. And that's not a bad thing to realize because it's true. I need oxygen, of course, for 2 minutes, and if I didn't have it, I'd die. I need a lot of things that I've got. I need you. I need a world. I'm not meant to be alone. We can't cope on our own. We're not meant to. So it's an honest appraisal of our own dependence. And ultimately, our dependence is on God, the source of everything we are. And that's the fact of it. So to accept that fact, but I've got to add something really important. Humility is Jesus accepting that God is his Abba. I do nothing except what my Father gives me. I only do my Father's will. Seek all this. Jesus is a child of God, but God's there. I mean, that's critical. He rejoices to be God's child. He rejoices to need God. He goes off into the mountain to pray because he needs to pray. He's all the time open to God's revelation of love because God has said, I love you, you're my son, and with you I'm well pleased. So it's a joy of knowing that the one on whom he utterly depends is the loving God. So it's an acceptance of dependence, which is realistic and honest and true. It's being in touch with the real, but the real is that I'm loved. And if that's real, and if God... because God is infinitely knowing. It's rejoicing to be only capable of doing a little bit, having so many gifts. But that's good. And God has given me these gifts. And if I'm a widow with 2 little cent pieces, that's the best thing to do is give the 2 cent pieces. You don't have to compare with anybody. You don't have to be better than anybody or worse than anybody. You have to be you. So humility is a violet, rejoicing in being a violet just by the path and not looking at the oak tree and saying, oh, I wish I could give shade to the horses. Because the oak tree is looking at the violet and thinking, oh, God, these bloody horses. I wish I could just be a purple little flower like a violet. And instead of wishing and wanting and looking and thinking we're not and we are and I'm this and I'm strutting and that not, forget the whole damn thing and be yourself is humility. Because being yourself is the most beautiful thing you can be. And there's a joy in being yourself. With all the limitations, all the needs, all the dependence, something like that is the virtue of humility. And why it doesn't appear in any of the moral writings till Christianity is because thinking of yourself as something that's small Didn't Jesus say, unless you become as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven? Thinking of yourself as something small was not what human beings were socialized into doing. Except Jesus was delighted to be small, delighted to be human, delighted to be there, and delighting in God's love. So he called God Abba.